Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hi, this is Mike Keyes with ID the Future, and today we get to continue our conversation with Mike Flannery, who, like me, is a historian of science, and so we have got some common interests here in the life and work of course, Charles Darwin, but also other figures that interacted with Darwin, contemporaries. They exchanged letters and spoke with one another, particularly Charles Lyell and also Alfred Russel Wallace. And of course, Mike Flannery has written a book about Alfred Russel Wallace, actually a couple books, but a book that he authored recently with Discovery Press back, well, actually 2011, is called Alfred Russel Wallace, A Rediscovered Life. Now, Mike, in the title here, we have A Rediscovered Life. Tie in this idea of rediscovering Wallace with the conversation we've been having about Wallace, Charles Darwin, and Charles Lyell. Are there some things worthy to be noticed that others have overlooked about Wallace?
Well, I think so. Wallace, because of his views on the nature of biology, and as he developed his views, he increasingly came to view biology as really dependent upon some kind of mind or intelligence. And because of that, Wallace, by virtue of that fact, becomes a pretty controversial figure.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at a lot of writings on Wallace, and there have been some good biographies done of Wallace, but what I wanted to emphasize were in Rediscovered Life was some aspects of Wallace that perhaps have not been as well emphasized, and to view him as a complete whole. Not only his views about natural selection, which, as we mentioned in the previous podcast, he had co-discovered with Darwin, but also his important work on the geographical distribution of animals, which was a significant book he published in 1876. And then also his later views on the importance of purpose, or fancy word for that is teleology, in the natural world. And so I think in some senses that teleological view of biology is the rediscovered portion of Wallace.
Okay. So last time we discussed how Wallace reviewed Charles Lyell's 10th edition of his famous book, Principles of Geology, saw that this was consistent with his own idea of intelligent design, as we would now call it today. And then Darwin went to Lyell, hoping to get ammunition to repel this design inference from the kind of work that Lyell was doing, and Darwin didn't get what he was looking for. So the last, where we left off, was you were describing how Lyell affirmed, actually, what Wallace got out of his work, that you know, you look at the way small changes occur over time in artificial selection, it requires intelligence to shape significant novelty, and there are good reasons to infer this also in natural selection and biology, that particularly when it comes to humans, right? That's kind of where we left off, is how to explain the origin of humanity. Isn't that the key point here?
That was sort of the lightning rod for this discussion. And Lyell completely really sides with Wallace on this whole issue. And not only does he not give Darwin the sort of support he was looking for, but he actually sort of shoots a little volley against Darwin's own artificial selection analogy or domestic breeding analogy, by talking about, well, we would never get a monstrosity like a Poulter pigeon without some directed guidance on the part of a breeder to create one.
Right.
So he's not only siding with Wallace, but he's also shooting sort of a pretty pointed arrow at Darwin's own domestic breeding analogy. So I'm sure that Darwin, at the end of the day, did left Lyell's letter with a great deal of sort of a disconcerting feeling that he had been abandoned.
Yeah.
Now, he had been abandoned by Lyell, who he greatly appreciated and greatly admired. So it was kind of, I'm sure it was for Darwin, a bit of a crushing blow. Now, there's different ways of looking at uniformitarianism, which, as we mentioned in the last podcast, was really the new idea that Lyell introduced to geology. And then Darwin takes this idea of slow, gradual change and applies it to biology. And for Darwin, the fossil record was supposed to be the demonstrable observation of this uniformitarian principle of slow change over time. Now, it can be construed as a doctrine of uniformity in science, that causality in the physical world remains constant and invariable throughout time and space. So that was another important addition to this concept of uniformitarianism. In other words, the idea that the principle of gravitation or the speed of light is as true here as it is in any solar system or galaxy. In other words, the core laws of physics and science are universal. And so, in a sense, Darwin, in applying this uniformitarian principle, he felt he was applying good, solid scientific principles in his analysis.
Right.
But Lyell himself disagreed.
Yeah, you know, we had just kind of broached the topic of when Lyell mentioned you should explain the past in terms of presently acting causes, or what he called actual causes, you know, ones that could be seen in action today. And of course, most of the time we see these causes operating in settings where the intensity is, you know, fairly docile, it's gradual, but occasionally there are instances of rapid change. So is there, there has been a history of different versions of uniformitarianism, some more strict, others more open-ended. So it sounds like, from the last thing you said, the constancy of natural laws, I mean, it's pretty much, you need to, in order to do science, you need to assume that the world in the past operated by the same kinds of natural laws that operate today. And that assumption is has been very productive for science, but could it prematurely limit your options if you up front demand that the causes operating in the past, although of the same kind, also had to be operating at the same intensity or rate at which we see processes happening today? What do you think about that in terms of the development of these ideas?
That's true. It can get a little sticky at times, and we have to separate out, I think, when we take a look at events in deep history, in deep time, what is important and what isn't. Let me give an example. I mean, these uniformitarian principles are important and they're useful in science. And in fact, Steve Meyer, for example, makes an important point that there's a lot of reasons to say that ID could be considered a scientific argument based upon these uniformitarian principles. He outlines this pretty clearly, I think, in four ways. He says Darwin's argument for descent with modification is similar to ID in that both are abductive inferences to the best explanation, which is a form of reasoning that really calculates backwards to infer past conditions and causes from manifest effects, or in other words, historical reasoning from clues back to causes.
Right.
That's what this really is. But then he says this allows you to both address questions in deep history, which is what ID is doing, and what Darwin was trying to do. And both have profound, you can't escape it, metaphysical implications. You can't say, well, you know, Darwinian evolution is science and ID isn't. Well, no, they both have metaphysical implications. But both are the same types of inquiry with very different answers. And I might add that ID's answer is not an answer premised on gaps, which is often claimed, but it's based on known cases of complexity derived from known intelligent causes. And I guess the classic example is Scrabble letters strewn on a table in no particular order would not lead anyone to conclude that an intelligence was behind them. But if they spelled happy birthday, Mike, we might both conclude that somebody was wishing us a happy birthday. We may not know who, but somebody was.
At least one of the Mikes maybe had a birthday.
Right. So Steve Meyer basically argues that we can apply this same reasoning to genetic code. Darwin's problem is that he had tried to account for complexity through random chance processes. And to get us back to our original discussion, that's what Lyell and Wallace and really many of the contemporaries of Darwin in the areas of science disagreed with. St. George Ivor disagreed with him. William Poole disagreed with him. John Herschel disagreed with him. Herschel scoffed at Darwin's theory of natural selection, called it the law of higgledy-piggledy.
Yeah.
And the only ones who really favored Darwin's view and why they did is a whole other couple of podcasts. But the only ones who really fervently stood behind Darwin's view was Thomas Henry Huxley and nine other of his ex-club called the so-called ex-club colleagues, who really met monthly from 1864 to 1893 to promote and strategize for the victory of Darwinian evolution. Interestingly enough, in 1869, when all this occurred, you know, Wallace's split from Darwin and Lyell's letter back to Darwin basically supporting Wallace. It's 1869 that this ex-club group led by Huxley founded a major outlet for their campaign, and that was the journal Nature under the editorship of Norman Lockyer.
Right.
And Janet Brown, I guess, is by all accounts the leading biographer of Charles Darwin, at least currently, has said, you know, far more than any other science journal, Nature was conceived, born, and raised to serve a polemical purpose.
Right.
Now, that's not me talking. That's Janet Brown. So,
So you get a sort of an old boys network. If you're a member of the club or friends of the club, you might get published. But if you don't pull the party line, well, maybe you won't get published, right?
Yeah, and it should be pointed out that Lyell and Wallace was not invited to the Yikes Club dinners.
Okay, yeah. So we focused on the really big term uniformitarianism as initially developed by Charles Lyell as explaining the past in terms of actual causes known to be in action at the present. And of course, Lyell also emphasized the gradualness of these processes. And then you mentioned Steve Meyer says, hey, you can frame the argument for intelligent design as an inference to the best explanation in which we are also explaining the past in terms of causes presently known to operate, namely intelligent causes. So, you know, if you were to spin off a transcript of our conversation, it would be a series of letters and spaces that capture our conversation. And it's clear that two intelligent minds, Mike and Mike, were talking with each other. So, and you see the same kind of information in the DNA of living organisms and in other codes found in the living cell. So you were explaining that Steve Meyer has made the argument that, in fact, it stretches clear back to his dissertation at the University of Cambridge, that ID, like Darwinism, is an inference to the best explanation. Now, there's a debate over which is the best explanation, but they're both the same kinds of inferences, reasoning from present effects back to past causes. We know what intelligence can do, the kinds of things it can produce, and we can see that in human history. Letters exchanged between Darwin and Wallace, obviously intelligently created letters, and we can see it in natural history. So it sounds like we can learn a lot from the history of science to better understand current debates about evolution and design. Any last thing you'd like to say, Mike, about what you've learned by studying Lyell and Darwin and your best friend, Wallace, who you've written books about?
Yeah, well, I think the take-home message is that when we look at the history of science, we look at the history of biology, we don't want to think or delude ourselves in believing that Darwin gave the only and final answer.
Yeah.
He did not give the only and final answer.
There was a lively dialogue back then about what all this stuff meant, and it wasn't just one view, right? It was multiple competing views.
Absolutely, absolutely, and a rather robust debate. And you can trace this out and continuing it on into the future. You know, you see, as the Darwinian view rose to become the reigning paradigm, there is still this small, steady, perceptible voice of professional dissent. Now, I want to underscore professional dissent. It's not just, you know, some religious fanatics in the background saying, oh, this can't be. I mean, early geneticist Hugo de Vries famously said, natural selection may explain survival of the fittest, but it can't explain arrival of the fittest. So there were always questions about how Darwin's blind processes in biology was a sufficient explanation. And I guess the take-home point is that we can all think a little more expansively about this, think out of the box, and let's sort of divest ourselves of this sort of Darwinian straitjacket that says there's only one way it had to be, and any other way is not science. That's not true. And in fact, I would say much of what I said about Steve Meyer, I would recommend the readers or the listeners read Steve Meyer's Signature in the Cell and also his book, Darwin's Doubt. Those two excellent works will cast this all in a fresh light, I think.
Yes, indeed. Steve Meyer is both a historian and a philosopher of science, and there are sections of those books that deal a little bit with the history. And perhaps this conversation will spark the interest in our listeners to check out some of this history, both in your books, Mike, and Steve Meyer's books. And I've got a book of my own coming out later this year. So, you know, history of science is not just dead white males, mostly dead white males, but it's a story of multiple competing views, different philosophical perspectives. It brings the excitement back to science. It gives the richness of science back to the student of science. And I think it enriches science education. So thank you so much for joining us today for this follow-up conversation, Mike. And we look forward to your future work on Alfred Russel Wallace.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. This is Mike Keyes with ID the Future. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to you connecting with this podcast in the future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.